It was my distinct pleasure to talk with Mike Green about the use of asset-based approaches in his work. I've been interested in considering ways to adopt an asset-based orientation in higher education since I first learned about the application of assets models in a variety of different fields of practice. Mike has never worked in higher education, but he has been in the business of building human capital, both through his poverty reduction work and through his work with people with disabilities. Mike lives in Denver, Colorado, and serves as an affiliated faculty member for the Asset-Based Community Development Institute, which is housed in Chicago. In orienting listeners to this interview, I want to point out that throughout the conversation, Mike Green refers to another Mike, who is my brother, and another colleague of his named Diamon Harges. Mike Mather and Diamon worked together for many years in community development in inner city Indianapolis, and Mike Green knew them and their work because of their collective interest in asset-based community development. I began the interview by asking Mike to say a bit about his work with people with disabilities and how asset-based community development informed that work.
Mike, I'll go ahead and jump in. With the first question, you know, I asked you, and I'm interested in hearing about, you know, your work with people with disabilities, and particularly how you saw the asset-based approach coming into your work. How did you discover it, and why did it resonate with you, and how you incorporated it?
Before I knew there was something called asset-based community development, my daughter kept teaching me about her gifts and her way of seeing the world, which was very much about seeing the possibility in people rather than the disability in people. Always, she's like relentlessly focused on what people have rather than don't have. Annie is her name. And when she was a little girl, we had several experiences with people who were, I mean, we were primarily influenced by the medical model of seeing her as somebody broken to fix. But we kept finding disconfirming kind of evidence, and also a few people who were outside of that world, right, of helper, who kept pointing out that this actually wasn't who Annie is. And then when you first came across the ABCD approach was with Judith Snow, who became Annie's godmother and who Mike Mather knows well. And she was a part of our, what we're called the faculty group. And she's a person with significant physical disabilities, only moves from her neck up and her one thumb, but she moves her mouth pretty determinedly and has plenty to say about everything. And she died in 2015, but she really pushed me around and just was determined that I not see Annie as a disabled, broken person. And she just kept pointing out that that's not who Annie is, any more than it's who anybody is. And then I would say my approach, and then I found that ABCD fit with this view and John McKnight. And basically, I would say very briefly, fundamentally, the approach to disabilities of asset-based community development is that there is no disability. There are people with differences and requiring deeper listening and a different array of supports, right? We all need supports in order that we develop who we are and can contribute who we are. And that's more the perspective. And there are two kind of activities, I would say, that are essential to ABCD. One is to support the individual around their gifts being contributed in their dreams. So that's really about listening to using Annie as an example, to Annie, and then to deciding what would help her, cross the bridge and from where she is to where she might want to be. And then the other side of it is really connects to what you were saying, Pete, about the generosity you've encountered in your travels so far. There is, I think, uniquely, in a way, there's an ABCD conviction that communities are inherently welcoming places, given a chance. So the question becomes how to rig the circumstances that a community can be welcoming, right, and generous. So it's really about creating those circumstances. And, you know, a good example that we're both quite familiar with, Mike and Diamon at Broadway, that'd be one way I'd summarize their work, was just a whole variety of ways to set it up to create a context for generosity and welcome. And, and I think in general, that would be how I'd summarize ABCD, those two things in practical terms. How to support people's gifts to be given and dreams to be expressed, and then how to support a community to welcome.
Okay. Great. What are some things, particularly for places like this, these research universities that are busy doing and have, diverse arms and all that kind of thing.
A couple of thoughts that come in this moment is maybe a dilemma is that the doing and the being are out of balance, right? And that so much more into doing and we're so much less into being, and particularly being in our body, that so a lot of our doing, like the person that you were quoting, the who meditates 2 hours a day, and they're, that's, I find it interesting how many people that are considered, world-class thinkers, that is a part of what they do, is they have committed to a deep contemplative practice of some kind. And it's, I think, because it establishes a different balance, right? And they're aware that they have a better decision-making and discernment if they're more integrated of mind and body. And so I think the same thing is true for an individual, it's true for collective. And that's a real dilemma, is that our institutions are mostly disembodied, and there's nobody home in a sense, and that creates the problem. So there's a lot of doing, not very grounded. And so back to that guardian, the assumption of the guardian is that there's a container that holds values, principles, practices, there's that holds the ground that we're standing on. And if it's just a leaky bucket where nobody, it won't hold water, then it's a real problem. And I think that would be one way that I think about it. But the, what an institution might do besides the practices that we've named, people meditating together, however briefly, sitting in circle, those assume, I think, one thing I've thought about a lot during the years that I was working and traveling is how do you take a big place and chunk it down into, within the big place, smaller places, right? And I think, for one thing, Christian churches and also all sorts of faiths have recognize the value of small communities, right? And in a way, I don't know that much about, the big, the mega churches and evangelical, but one of the things they've done is I've heard repeatedly the few people I know in that world talk about their deep sense of community and family, but that's their little home group, right? That they really live their life with, even though they're on Sunday morning with 3,000 people or whatever, it still feels like it's their home group. And so one of the key practices might be, how do we take a big institution and create ways that it can be small? How can we create little places that are more relational, that are slower, more slowed down, right? Where and require collective. That'd be the other thing that I think about is like that fundamental social law. How do we create circumstances where people need each other? And go against this kind of rabid individualism, right? That it, like a thing, like Carol, my wife, who you didn't meet, because she was up at that music camp, one of her big complaints about the classical music world is how competitive it is. And it creates that among kids. And, you know, they're having all these stupid contests and all. And instead of working together to create something, they try to be best. And I think, you know, can we set up circumstances? I'd say that's a good guiding question. How do we make a big place small? You know, create small places within a big place, and how do we slow it down in some places where people can notice the beauty? And how do we make it more relational, like sitting in circle would be a good guiding question. And how do we set up circumstances where people need each other? And I think at least some parts of the, particularly, you know, the for-profit world, there really is a sensitivity about that. And I'm not a big organizational development person, but I've just noticed over the years that, you know, particularly some of the higher tech companies, they really, and, you know, they set up circumstances where people can be creative together. Like our neighbor, our next door neighbor, I think I might have even mentioned it. The woman is a doctor and the guy works, he's some kind of software person at Google in Boulder, but he used to go every day to the Google, wherever their thing is, their big office. Yeah. Well, they still have their big office, but he's only going to be going there like a day or two a week, but only to be with other people, right? And then he can be anywhere he wants for the work that's more his individual work. But they just are recognizing there's a certain value to encouraging or requiring people have to do some things together. And I think that's an interesting, you know, all of those things are really about organizational design, but it's pretty straightforward, right? It'd be pretty easy that people could sit in circle or be quiet for 5 minutes before they go on to have the 3.5 hour meeting or whatever, you know, or they could, you know, have certain things they're doing together. You don't have to go on Outward Bound to do something together. Institution anyway, and you know, valuing solitary things too, like the aimless wandering, you know, anyway. So I think there's a lot that can be done, that, and I think one of the things is just to trust common sense. And I think this was such an important thing that John McKnight, the ABCD founder, has been a champion for, and you know, forever, is the idea that, I mean, he quotes this Sufi story that you'll only learn what you already know. And the question is how to reveal that, right? That wisdom.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, it's true. And it's also true back to the doing and the value of institution. And we could all use a little training, right? There's a place for both, obviously. For learning and skill building and all of that. But we do have a lot more wisdom. I do think we're in a world, our conventional world, where the wisdom of everyday life is minimized, right? And the expertise of special knowledge is more valued to our detriment. You know, like I often think about, like, people, you know, in an extreme example, people calling in to a reality show to ask somebody like a Dr. Phil what they should do about their marriage instead of talking to their friend or neighbor, right? And, you know, it's just insane, right? Or how prone we are. And I've benefited, like my wife Carol and I, and me particularly, I had violence when I was a child. And I found therapy from a good therapist really valuable in my life. Mm-hmm. But I also recognize that it's an overutilized commodity, mm-hmm. right? That, that we've commodified the kind of wisdom in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And the assumption that a therapist knows, I'm also, you know, I was a licensed social worker, even though I didn't work as a therapist, but I met a lot of absolutely ridiculously stupid therapists. Right, that, you know, that you wouldn't want to drive you across town, let alone tell you how to live your marriage, right? Yeah. So, I mean, it doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. And we overvalue expertise, I would say, so-called expertise. And so I think, you know, can you set up a circumstance where I think most of the things that make a difference, in my opinion, are basic things like this friend that I talked about, who's done all this embodiment work, she often works with consultants and often very high powered people. And they want to refer to her as a consultant. And she adamantly says, I am not a consultant. I'm a dancer. I'm going to tell you how to live in your body. And you can choose to do it or not, but do not ever call me a consultant. And she considers it an obscenity because it's saying that I know better than you know. Uh-huh. And I do think, and I worked in that world, and Diamon works in that world now. And I think it's a constant challenge. I mean, the idea that somebody getting off a plane knows what you should do more than you or your neighbor knows what to do is really a real, it says a lot about the world that we've created, right? This commodification of wisdom. We've made it into this product that you buy. And I do think, you know, we need to restore more confidence, which I think can easily happen in institutions by adapting some of these simple practices and 100 others that you'll come up with as you aimlessly wander through this world. But really, you will. You'll have a whole list of things that I would suggest could be, that would take people more into their body, more into the present moment, more into their collective wisdom. And then people will have confidence that they actually do, as John McKnight would say, they do know, right? They really do know. And yeah, they could use some help along the way, like the poet said, or Suzuki Roshi, we all could use some help. But we're basically, we're just fine.
Yeah. One thing I'm thinking about, back when you were talking about the convictions, one thing that stood out to me, and you didn't use the word specifically, but humility.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it was a subtext, I think, of what you were talking about. Yeah. Again, back to university expertise and specialization and those things, it seems like it's really important in order for us to be able to do, you know, what we're hoping to do or be who we're hoping to be.
Yeah.
I think it's
something really important. And it's not just in the academic world. I mean, it's in any professionalized world, right? Where people have invested time and money into a professional identity. I think, you know, I mean, you could say most religious life is pastor centered, right? You could say most helping human service world is helper centered, right? There's a kind of, if not explicit, then implicit hierarchy. And people And I think it's maintained on both sides of the fence. I mean, we do live in, it's a reality in a kind of consumer society, right? And the person who gets designated producer has an investment in that side of it. And the person mm-hmm. who's designated consumer wants to think that that'll work also often, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's really maintained. You know, it really is a kind of, and it's most, I think one of the problems is it's mostly invisible to people. We're like the fish swimming in the water, right? We're so used to it as being a normal thing that, you know, I've got a PhD and I've suffered through all of this. And so I definitely know, and, mm-hmm. or I've got off the airplane and you're paying me a $500 or $1,000 for a day of something. So I need mm-hmm. to make it worthwhile so I can get on the plane and be paid again. You know, I mean, people have a strong self-interest, but also mm-hmm. the person using that example who writes the check to a Mike Green who gets off the plane and who listens to me and makes notes and gives me a check. You know, he wants to believe it's worthwhile, right? And so everybody has a stake in this in a way.
Yeah.
So I think, but, you know, if we can gently set up ways that a more egalitarian way of working, a more fraternal way of working emerges, then a more joyful way of working. There's not, one mm-hmm. thing I always have noticed, or for a long time noticed, is the more that I was working in this kind of way, a hierarchical way, the less joyful it is. Mm-hmm. And the more it's more like this, the happier it is, or even like this, right? Mm-hmm. Just offering to and not necessarily even knowing what people will do with it. And I think it, you know, again there, I mean, some of these structures, I mean, a university, and you know a lot more about that world than me, but it is a hard world. I do know about, I do have, you know, at least I do have a professional degree, a social work, and mm-hmm. people have a real stake in that. And I guess my main professional experience was being a traveling consultant. And like my example, I mean, I found myself more and more troubled by my need to make people think that I knew better than they did.
Yeah.
And it was made me more and more sick in my stomach over time. And then I started changing the way that I worked, but I realized there was this edge. I was fearful that mm-hmm. they would say, well, then why in the hell do we need, if we already know, why do we need him to come? And we used to tell institutional city government people that mm-hmm. he said, you could create a space where you could create something different, but don't think you're going to reform the whole system.
Yeah.
You know, you're just creating a setup for going nuts. But you can create a small space where you can open a space to do something different. And that's, uh-huh. when I was doing all the traveling, that's what gave me, you know, whether it's a congregation or whether, you know, so, I mean, the United Methodist world is not going to change, right, as a whole. But that right. doesn't mean that Mike's church can't be something amazing.
Uh-huh.
And it may yeah. be different after he's gone or whatever, right? And uh-huh. likely will be, good or bad, better mm-hmm. or worse. But, you know, for a time, by opening a space, a smaller space, yeah, to me, that's good enough. And that's pretty real in terms of the realism and idealism that's realism. You know, yeah. small scale is more workable.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. I appreciate that.
And I think that's very relevant to your, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, how can you create circumstances where people can try some stuff? One a very last thing I think about is, I think it's really helpful if people can see themselves as pioneering, as a, you know, that is one other practice, like the sitting in circle and the short meditation or the, you know, silent walking, aimless wandering, those kind of thing, is learning conversations, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's just, that Mike does, and that we're soon going to try to get all, you know, really everybody at his church doing, is that the more people are doing that, the more good things happen. And it's the core practice of American community organizing. I mean, back to the time of Saul Alinsky and, you know, the kind of the 30s in the beginning and the labor movement, is that people listening to each other and going out and having meaningful conversation. And in a way, I think it's a radical act in the world we live in. We have so many meaningless conversations, right? People are surrounded by conversations like, what do you think of the Broncos, instead of what do you think about you know, our friend who's dying, and how does it make you think about your own mortality? I mean, you know, having real conversations are really valuable to people. And I think people find them so nourishing that somebody actually wanted to listen to them talk about their life. And Mike is, that's what he basically does, I think. And, but there's a saying in the community organizing world that even the accountant and lawyer have to do one-to-one conversations. And I think, you know, that's a practice that could be easily adapted to any smaller scale setting in a university, is that, you know, instead of having a planning meeting about our future, why don't we, in pairs, why don't we have some really thoughtful conversations listening to each other, or listening to people that have been former students or whatever it is, right? But listening, and then periodically coming together to share what was heard. And people love to know what other people say, like something, using me as an example, it'd be very interesting to me as you have more conversations. What did you talk about, and how did that affect you, and what did they have to say? And in a way, we're all on this journey with you, right? There'll be a growing number of people that are in this circle. And wouldn't it be neat, even if it's on the Zoomer or something, at some point to tell us what you've heard? And, you know, it wouldn't need to be specific, but what are the themes that have come up? Would be really, I mean, I could just say for me, like, I'm hoping that at Mike's church that that'll be something we do, as more and more people have been listened to by different peoples, that people will come together and reflect on what collectively, what have we heard through this deeper listening? And it's, you know, anyway, but that'd be another one, these kind of deeper listening conversations.
Yeah. You know, one thing, just I because I'm, my world is mostly in student affairs, and that's really what my book focus is. And I don't know how much you know about student affairs.
Not much, but nothing.
But it's, you know, it is more like the formal, out of class, student life, educators. I mean, sometimes it's managers, sometimes it's educators, right? But like the residence hall directors, the deans of students, the academic advisors. And, you know, one thing I'm thinking about is where the, you know, we talked about the different layers of an institution. There's like the business part of the institution. There's the ivory tower part of the institution. And then in this world of student affairs, has really been in historically more attention to like the holistic person.
Yeah. How do we, that's great.
Yeah. And, but I'm thinking that because that is one of the sub, I mean, even some at a big university, these are still, you know, 200, 300 people, you know, that comprise this unit. But it just strikes me that one of the things I can think about is how can these people, again, it's about humility. I don't want to say become the experts in this, but become proponents of these sorts of conversations, these kind of practices at an institution. And in, I mean, first practice it with each other, practice it in our work with students, practice it in our conversations with academic colleagues.
I think that's a brilliant idea because, I mean, in any institution, at least my experience is what I think works best is to find where's the easiest place, right? Like like the student affairs people naturally think more holistically because they're thinking about a student's whole life, not how they do, I don't know, their French grammar, right? They're thinking about their life. And so they're naturally more holistic. And so that sounds really good. And then you could think about, well, how do you introduce even in a small scale, some practices, and then out of those prototypes of trying out some things like the learning conversation, the circles, the stillness, whatever it is, then have some context for people to share their experience that could be communicated. And then others, what I think often happens is because it works, right? I mean, if people are in more relationship, they like it. Then if they talk about liking it and valuing it, and then others hear about it, then they think, okay, we could do some of that. That's not such a complicated thing. We could set up ways that people could talk to each other more or spend slowed down time together more. And then I think then it does actually have a kind of rippling effect. It can become very influential. And I do think in institutions that's often, that's been my best experience of how change happens is to open a space where something different can happen and then have a way to communicate why it worked better, you know, but through the actual experience of people, you know, participating in whatever the practice is. And then people like in AA, which is a part of my background, there's a statement that AA is a program of attraction, not promotion, that people are attracted to it, not, you know, advocated. I mean, you can be pushed into it, but you don't stay unless you're attracted. And I think that's what we're trying to do is set up circumstances that people be attracted to a more human way of living. And I think like a friend who I haven't seen in a long time, but a wonderful play. Well, I think Diamon and might quote her, but she many years ago talked about, she found an organization called Beyond Welfare. It was focused really on women transforming their life who'd been in violent marriages. And she said, I once heard an interview and somebody asked her, well, what's the purpose of Beyond Welfare? And she said, well, we're trying to set up circumstances where people can fall in love with each other. And that's a pretty profound mission statement. So and in a variety of ways they did things, and some of them were the very things we've talked about, like their core practice was circle. You know, because it's just so, you know, relational about human being, whole human beings, you know.
I'm so grateful for this, and I can't believe this is just one of these moments too in my experience here that you know, your ideas, your time, your generosity is like just really appreciated, you know.
So I feel the same, and I really valued our conversation and enjoyed it, and it's been very nourishing to me.
Well, Mike, thank you so much. This is, again, you're generous with your time, and I am certain we will. If you're willing, I certainly
love to talk more. I'd love to read what you write, which is beautiful writing, and you know, just was very moving to me. I mean, it really gave me a lot to think about, and I'm looking forward to really more carefully reading again. And so I really love the idea of being a part of your circle in this journey.
Great.
Until the next time, I will look forward to it.
Sounds good, Mike. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.